Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2005 was the most intense hurricane season on record. We are just about a month away from the beginning of hurricane season 2006. The forces of this planet are to be respected. Here's the message from 2005. Global warming, it's real. Things are heating up. And when what's heating up is the oceans, which they are, the stormy debate about climate change had better shake hands with the truth. We give you reason to believe when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News. There was a time in America when institutions of science, the great institutions and those who worked with them, held a lot of respect. But science has somehow been turned into the enemy to many. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, to many, stands sentry to the truth about the science of the oceans. Their legacy is sound. Joining us now from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is Dr. William B. Curry, senior scientist, whose work on the past history of climate and ocean circulation, particularly how large changes in ocean circulation and chemistry have affected the carbon cycle and ice age climates, discusses the changes in our oceans and what that means to you. This week we're focused on global warming, particularly because it's going to be the topic of a symposium that's being held at the Stegner Center in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's a topic that everybody seems to be talking about. There's certainly huge debate. There's all sorts of discussion as to whether or not it exists or if it's just perhaps an aberration in some sort of climatic history. So to help us try to figure out some of this, we're talking to the experts today. And joining us now from Woods Hole in Massachusetts is Dr. William Curry. He's a senior scientist with Woods Hole. Bill, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is such a huge topic, and there are so many divergent opinions about this. Why don't we start out with just having you give us a sense of where you stand in terms of this issue of, and we'll use the term global warming, but I want to expand that because I think global warming sometimes is a little misleading as to what we're really confronting here. But in terms of the debate about global warming, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts on this are that it's very clear that we are perturbing the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere. And that must change the energy balance of the climate system. It's adding energy to the climate system that's going to alter things like the temperature of the atmosphere, which is what most people think of when they think of global warming. But also energies going into melting of ice or energies starting to be stored in the oceans. The oceans are warming slightly, not a lot, but there's an awful lot of energy that's going into the oceans. And I'm a geologist, and I've studied climate on much longer timescales, and I know that the amounts of CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere now has raised the CO2 level to a point where it's much higher than it's been in anything at any time, say, for the last 600,000 years that we can measure from, say, ice core records of CO2 in the atmosphere, things like that. So I'm fairly convinced that we're altering the climate system. I'm unsure as to how rapidly or how warm it will get in the future, but the trend will be towards a warmer Earth. The atmosphere will get warmer and ice sheets will melt and sea level will rise. The rate that this is going to occur is a little bit unclear because some of the models are not as well developed as we'd like them to be. But I fall on the side of things that says that if you're going to continue to add CO2 to the atmosphere, then the Earth's energy balance is going to change in a way that, in general, the Earth is going to get warmer.
Certainly, the science is proving that the CO2 levels are rising.
There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. And because of this blanketing effect, therefore the air trapped underneath that is warming, and that translates into a general warming. And what your specialization certainly are the effects that global warming has on on the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Although there may be slight changes in the air temperature, this translates into increases in water temperature, and of course, and I'm going to have you expand on this, a tremendous amount of that energy is captured by the water, and that becomes part of the complexity in terms of trying to figure out what's going to happen, because once this warmth is captured in the oceans, that begins to set up some changes, and as you say, the capacity to figure out what those changes may be and how fast they occur are so complex that we're really left sort of guessing. So let's talk a little bit about what happens as the oceans start to warm.
First of all, as the Earth's climate system is gaining energy, as best as we can tell right now, about 20% of it's gone into warming the atmosphere, and about 70 or 80% has gone into warming the oceans. And that warming is distributed over a lot of the upper water column. So there's small changes in temperature of the ocean that have absorbed lots of energy. Okay? Now what that means is that the ocean is storing heat right now. The ocean itself can store heat for a long time, but it also can release heat as it circulates, so that whenever warmer waters move to a location where the atmosphere is a little bit cooler, that heat comes out of the ocean and back up into the atmosphere. So the ocean is affecting the climate system in that way, and as the ocean warms, it's going to delay the warming of the atmosphere, but ultimately affect the atmosphere in other locations as the ocean circulates. And the other major thing that happens when you start to warm the oceans is that you change the evaporation that occurs from the oceans into the atmosphere, so that a warm water evaporates fresh water from the oceans into the atmosphere. That's generally happening more at low latitudes. And then as the atmosphere moves more towards the poles and it cools, that water rains out. So in general, when you have this warming system with the ocean and the atmosphere involved, what you'll be seeing is a net movement of fresh water from the surface of the low-latitude oceans to higher-latitude locations on land and over the oceans. And so removing fresh water from low latitudes tends to increase the salinity in the tropical locations.
It's like boiling, if you have a pot of water with some salt in it, the more you evaporate the water, the more salty each gulp will taste.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. The water itself is not lost to the climate system. It's moved into the atmosphere and eventually rains out somewhere else. So what we tend to be seeing in the oceans right now is that tropical locations tend to be getting saltier and higher latitude locations tend to be getting fresher. And part of the interest oceanographers have in this is that the salinity, the salt content of the oceans, is the major player in the ocean's density. And density of seawater, to some extent, controls how the oceans circulate. So that will affect how the oceans circulate, and that, in turn, will affect the climate system. So that's the complexity that we're trying to work on, trying to understand what the impacts would be of this changing condition of the physical property of the seawater, this salinity change, which will affect density.
Well, now, for people who don't live in the realms that you do, this concept of circulating ocean water, it's a mystery to many, actually, but to other people who just really don't track on this, they don't have an understanding of why that would... So it's like, so what? So the water moves around in the ocean. What possible consequence would that have in reality? How does that really... How does the rubber meet the road in terms of why this is important?
Let me try to explain one way in which it's important. In the oceans today, the oceans near the equator are gaining a lot of energy because the sun is high in the sky and a lot of the energy is warming up the surface oceans there. And then there is a net flow from the equator towards the poles. There are several major currents that people would recognize their names. The Gulf Stream is one of these types of currents where the winds push the ocean water around, and what they're doing is driving warmer water from low latitudes towards high latitudes. And in the Atlantic Ocean, for instance, each winter, these warmer waters end up being warmer than the overlying atmosphere. So they give off heat to the atmosphere. So there's a net transfer of heat through this ocean circulation from low latitudes to high latitudes, and it has the effect of raising temperatures in the North Atlantic region by a significant amount each winter. It's more; it has a larger effect in the wintertime than it does in the summertime.
So those in Europe really benefit in the sense that their winters are not as severe as they may be if this current weren't there.
That is correct. But the current itself can't go away. The Gulf Stream is driven by the winds, but it may not go to as high a latitude at times. You know, that it may be diverted in its position, things like that. So one of the misconceptions that people have is that the Gulf Stream might shut down, and that's never true. The winds are going to continue to drive the Gulf Stream, but there can be changes in how the current is reacting with the atmosphere at higher latitudes, and that could cause changes in temperature in places like Europe. Yes.
So what's strange about this is that following that scenario, as we talk about global warming, if you're in Northern Europe regions, actually, it could actually cause the reverse effect, and that is that winters, for example, could become more severe.
It's possible that winters could become more severe if changes occur in the circulation system that are soon rather than far into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is that as we continue to add CO2 to the atmosphere, the overall temperature of the planet is going to continue to rise.
That's interesting, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that depending on how the ocean circulation changes over decades to century time scales, you could have more severe winters in Europe, although most of the models suggest that if the circulation changes, it'll be more on the time scale of about a century from now, at which case it would mitigate the warming as opposed to making things colder than today in that region.
So this, again, it reinforces this concept that these questions are extremely complex.
Exactly.
And why we can only assume what may happen.
We are using models to do more than just assume what will happen. We're trying to predict them using models that are not perfect. And, you know, what we're trying to do is understand the system better and better and to try to create models that are better predictors of the future.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, also, one of the aspects of these changes is the fact that we sort of, I think a lot of people, when they think about global warming, kind of imagine everything warming up. But one of the aspects of your research is that you spend time really focusing on very localized changes that may be out of proportion to an overall global warming because of the accumulation of different effects. And I'm just curious if you can share some of those kinds of things that you're witnessing around the planet.
Yeah. One of the things about the average temperature of the planet that, you know, when people talk about global warming, they're talking about a mean temperature of the planet rising. But not all locations are going to rise at the same amount or the same rate. And the other aspect about the changing climate is that in locations that are affected by changes in the hydrological cycle, by the rainfall and the evaporation, some places are likely to become wetter in the future scenario of a warmer Earth, while other places are likely to become drier. And that's one of the big issues, is predicting those regional changes. One of the things that I say to people when I'm talking about this sometimes is that nobody actually lives in the mean planetary temperature. Everybody lives in a local climatological state, and those local conditions don't necessarily track what the mean of the planet is doing. If the planet is actually getting warmer by a certain amount, some places get much warmer than that, and others get less warm than that. The same sort of thing happens with the rainfall and the evaporation. Some places are likely to become much, much wetter in the future. Other places are likely to become much, much drier because of these sorts of regional changes.
You've really studied climate throughout the ages,
mm-hmm.
and these part of the debate is the fact that we may be witnessing just an aberration. This happens all the time, swings this way, that way. What is your analysis of whether or not this is cyclic aberration. I don't know what the time frame would be, the decades or hundreds of years or thousands of years. And it can even be a number of few years. You know, some winters are worse than others. Where are you in terms of defining sort of what we're witnessing these days, particularly as it relates to the topic of these incredible series of hurricanes that happened?
Let me not address that about the hurricane specifically in
Fair
the
enough,
first
yeah.
part of my answer. Let me address where I am in terms of the overall climate system.
Sure.
The climate system does vary. There's no doubt about that. It varies on many different time scales. It changes because of very long, like hundreds of thousands of year changes in the Earth's orbital geometry, how far the Earth is from the sun, the shape of the orbit, the tilt of the planet's axis relative to the sun. Those are really long time scale changes. There are other shorter time scale changes that affect climate naturally as well. But what is different now is the rate of change of CO2 in the atmosphere caused by fossil fuel burning. We have not seen this rate of increase of CO2 in the natural system for as far back as we can measure CO2 changes in ice cores. So that, I believe, makes this outside the bounds of the natural variability. That's my take on it. Now let me try to address your question about the hurricanes. It is very difficult for any scientist to talk about, you know, any specific events or any specific summer's worth of hurricanes to be related to a specific cause like global warming, because the time scales of the change are longer than that. But one of the things that one might expect as the ocean begins to warm or continues to warm is that energy from warm surface oceans is what drives the intensity of hurricanes. And there were two papers published last summer that started to make the case that the intensity of hurricanes has been getting greater because the ocean surface temperatures are starting to warm. And that type of thing, the intensity of the hurricanes, seems to be a consensus starting to build among scientists that that's the type of scenario one would expect as the Earth continues to warm, the oceans continue to warm. I would never think of an event like last summer's hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico as necessarily a wake-up call about global warming specifically myself. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it is the type of change that one might expect to see in the longer-term future, that hurricanes might become more intense in the future. That's not to say there's a lot of debate about whether or not hurricanes will become more frequent. That is clearly not necessarily a consensus at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the nature of your research. Woods Hole is a romantic, beautiful legacy of science. Give us a sense of how you go out and you discover some of the things that you're working on.
Woods Hole is a big place, and there's a lot of people working on different aspects of climate. I'm a geologist, and I actually take ships out to sea and collect deep-sea sediment cores. And by measuring the chemistry of the fossils in those cores and dating their ages using radiocarbon dating techniques, I'm able to reconstruct what the climate was like several thousands of years ago. So some of us who were working in this kind of realm with the deep sea sediments are able to make these reconstructions and say, you know, how much colder was it 200 or 300 years ago in the North Atlantic during the period that's called the Little Ice Age?
Hmm.
That's one aspect of the type of work that goes on at Woods Hole. But there's also a whole lot of scientists who are working on the current modern conditions using a series of instruments where they take ships out to measure the temperature and the salinity and the currents that are in the oceans today, or they're deploying remote vehicles, floats that change their buoyancy and go up and down through the water column and then radio back through satellites what the temperature and salinity distribution is. And these floats are pushed around by the currents, so you can track their position through time with GPS, things like that. Or there are autonomous vehicles with wings, gliders, that do the same sort of thing where you can tell this glider to measure along a transect from a place like Woods Hole to Bermuda across the Gulf Stream to see what the temperature and salinity conditions are like there. that sort of work. So there's a broad spectrum at a place like Woods Hole of studying the oceans and how it relates, how it's changing, how its circulation affects climate. And it's happening on, you know, people who are wondering what's happening right now this winter. And there are people like me who wonder what it was like 1,000 years ago out in the North Atlantic, you know, to try to figure out the natural variability.
Well, there's a lot of talk these days of what appears to be a sudden shift in the rate of melt from the Arctic and Greenland, and a lot of talk about how various companies are beginning to lust after the gold and diamonds and copper that may lie under the exposed ground that now would be available. It's kind of interesting that they are planning almost for the shrinkage of these ice caps. What can you tell us about the status of the melting of the great ice caps in Greenland?
Well, I can only tell you what I've seen recently and read about. It's not what I actually work on. There does appear to be an acceleration in the amount of melting that's going on over Greenland. There does appear to be an increasing melt of the Arctic sea ice, the floating sea ice cap, that has reached some of its minimum extents ever observed during the last several summers. Both of these melting phenomena appear to be affecting the salinity at high latitudes. There seems to be more fresh water coming in at high latitudes that is at least in some way related to increased melting at high latitudes. So that for the past, say, approximately 50 years, which is about as far back as good salinity records go, there's been a net decrease in salinity at high latitudes that is related to a great extent to the interactions between the ocean and the ice at high latitudes. And some of the evidence now points toward an acceleration of melting of a large feature like Greenland. Now, it still may take several centuries to melt, but, you know, small amounts of changes in the melting have a large impact on the salinity at high latitudes and could affect the circulation up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's project out a little bit now and tell us what we might be looking to in our lifetime and throughout this century. How are we going to see the effects of the things you're working on?
Goodness, that's the hard question. I think our best estimates right now are that, you know, it's going to take close to a century to affect the salinity at high latitudes in any way that would significantly change how the ocean circulates there. And during that period of time, unless we reduce the emissions of CO2, the Earth's going to continue to warm. So I think that during our lifetime, during our children's lifetime, we're going to see an overall warming of the planet. I think that the issue that we have to figure out for the future is how wet will it be and how dry will it be in certain locations? One of the interesting things about this symposium at the Stegner Center is that it's taking place in the Mountain West, which is a location where evaporation exceeds precipitation. And, you know, places like that could get significantly drier in the future. And that's the type of thing that I couldn't predict that it will happen, but it's the type of thing that might happen, and it certainly, when you have a growing population in places where there are restricted water availability, that has an important problem to try to solve, try to understand. So I would say that, you know, over my lifetime we'll see the Earth get warmer and we'll see more stresses on the water supply. That would be my guess as to how things will go. It's somewhat of a guess at this point.
I know a lot of people are talking about just the cycles of storage of water as ice and snow in the mountains, and that we kind of have, over the centuries, become accustomed to that melt water and rely on that for our water supplies, and it has its kind of a controlled melt rate, that if that accelerates even a little bit, that can dramatically impact the loss of that water, which we can't just contain.
That's true.
And therefore, it could cause water shortages. Now we're talking off in the future here, or we don't know. It could happen 3 years from now. But that these are the kinds of impacts that we have to be aware of, that it could radically change, at times, our way of life in the sense that we may just not have access to water, particularly in the West, as we have in the past.
I wouldn't disagree with anything that you say there. You know, I think that, you know, when you talk about global warming, the warming of the planet is a lot easier to deal with than the changes in the hydrological cycle that are likely to accompany it. You know, you need water to maintain the populations in many parts of the country. There's limited water availability, and that could become stressed.
It's so complex. This discussion could go on for days, and it will actually at the Stegner Center this coming weekend. But one of the things that I think this is so interesting, because people talk about the raising of the ocean levels, but that because the oceans collect so much heat and become even a few degrees warmer, they expand. And that alone is one factor that could lead to a rising of the oceans.
Right. Yeah, it's one of the properties of seawater is that when it warms, it expands. And if enough of the water column warms, that's a large water column that expands a little bit, is a sea level rise that can affect coastlines for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I'm not an expert in, but my understanding of it is that much of the rise that we've seen so far has been more from thermal expansion, as I just spoke of, rather than from the addition of the fresh water due to melting.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future, if the ice sheets continue to melt, their rate of input of water will be the larger portion of that sea level rise, the added fresh water into the oceans.
Well, because these issues are so incredibly complex, obviously the need for more information increases exponentially. Talk about how you feel that the future of research may lead to a better understanding and therefore a better capacity to predict so that we can make plans economically and socially and politically about our future.
Well, there are still some very important first-order questions that need to be addressed and are addressable by scientists if they have the resources to do them. Among them are, how will cloud formation change? Because clouds are a very important part in the overall energy balance of the Earth's climate system. The other thing is how the oceans will change. And the oceans are far less well observed than the atmosphere is. It's difficult to get measurements from the ocean from below the surface. Satellites cover the surface really well, but to know what's going on beneath the surface requires ships or instruments to be out there making measurements. And we don't really have as good an observation system of the full climate system, the ocean and the atmosphere together, as we need. And there are still some fundamental aspects of how these two systems interact and how the ocean circulates that are not that well understood yet. So we could make significant improvements in our predictions for the future if we had this type of research continuing on and even enhanced even. So I think that there is a consensus among scientists that this is an issue. It's a really important issue. There's also an understanding by scientists that there are still important questions. I personally think that by changing the CO2 of the atmosphere, we are affecting the climate system, and it's going to have an impact on us. We need to better understand exactly what that impact is going to be so that we can prepare for the changes that we might need to make.
The research will continue. Dr. William Curry, senior scientist with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, I want to thank you for lending your voice to the Wild Side News. And also, if people want to learn more about what's happening at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, how can they do so?
Well, they could go onto our website, which is www.whoi.edu, and you'll find an awful lot of information about both the institution as well as the research going on in climate and in other areas about oceanography.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks to the Wallace Stegner Center of Salt Lake City for bringing these voices to this special edition of the Wild Side News. It's time to embrace the truth. You have just heard three of the world's leading authorities about climate change, who have spent years watching, recording, and analyzing the facts. The conclusion, for me, there's no doubt about it at all. Global warming. It's real. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks truth of the wonder, here on the Wild Side News.